Blog Talk Radio.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. This is Sinead, and Hex should be on the line.
Hello.
She is. Hey, Hex.
Hey.
I hope I'm coming through all right, because I'm using a new mic tonight. I had been using my little mic that comes with my headphones, but I got some feedback that it's almost impossible to listen to our shows. I think after they archive, it gets even worse. So hopefully this will clear up some of the annoyingness. Although some of it, I think, is just out of our control, even if we had good mics, because the connection just gets screwed up sometimes. That's annoying. But hopefully this will make things a little bit better for the listeners. So thank you for listening, everybody. Tonight we wanted to talk about birth trauma and the limbic imprint. What got me thinking about this was that that piece that Kyle read on one of his shows maybe a week or two ago about circumcision, and it really covered a lot about how it not only damages men, clearly, I mean, we know that, but it just damages everybody. Relationships are negatively affected. People are traumatized, and it just got me thinking about how many traumatic things happen to babies even before they're born, and then within the first, couple days of being earthside, and it really just, it blew my mind, because there are so many different things that are done to us that a lot of us might not have questioned before. I mean, I know I personally am just kind of in the past year or two, I've just started to really look at my own birth. Now, when I say that, I mean when my mother gave birth to me, or when I was taken from my mother's womb. I don't know if she gave birth to me. I was a C-section baby, but got me thinking about how, you know, we block a lot of that stuff out, but it has a lasting effect on us. And just real quick to explain what a limbic imprint is, I have a little definition here. And it says that the limbic imprint refers to the process by which prenatal, perinatal, and postnatal experiences imprint upon the limbic system, causing lifelong effects. The term is to explain how early care of a fetus, I hate calling it a fetus, of a baby, and newborn is important to lifelong psychological development and has been used as an argument for alternative birthing methods and against circumcision. Well, yeah, I mean, the fact that there's an argument still is ridiculous to me, but yeah, I thought we could maybe get into just what is happening to babies, what happened to us. I think a lot of us here in the United States especially, we're brought into the world in a less than ideal situation. A lot of us were brought to the world in hospitals, and I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, the birth was completely traumatic because it was in a hospital, but I think on some level, it is in a way, because we're being born into the arms of strangers, into masked people, masked strangers, people with weird gowns on, bright lights, machines. And I think this, just even that, you know, has a very negative impact on us. And if those are our first experiences after we leave the womb, you know, we're starting off on the wrong foot completely. And it's very troubling. So I guess one thing that I learned today and that I was talking with you about earlier, Hex, was apparently they have fetal surgery, which I think referring to a gestating baby as a fetus is really weird and very inhumane. And I think it is, we call it a fetus on purpose so we can kind of remove that human quality to the growing baby. And it's just a, you know, bunch of cells, which it is in the very beginning. I, you know, obviously agree with that, but from the early weeks of gestation, that baby looks like a baby. It's just really small. So yeah, apparently they will operate on a woman. First of all, diagnosing these fetal needs to have surgery is just ridiculous, in my opinion, because with ultrasounds, you know, they'll tell women all the time, your baby is deformed, they're going to have this problem and that problem, you should probably abort. And, you know, a lot of women won't listen, and they don't abort the pregnancy, and their baby's born fine. So I really want to know how a lot of these, you know, needs for surgery are being diagnosed while a baby is still in the womb. And that's just ridiculous to me. Are you still there?
Yeah, just going over some of the stuff that you sent me. Yeah, that they open the uterus, and you said also other stuff that you read, sometimes they take it out of the woman's body entirely.
Yeah, they'll usually perform a hysterectomy after that. I don't know why. I haven't been able to find much information on this. I think it's pretty new.
Yeah,
but
really,
I don't.
It was really vague as to why they felt that was necessary.
It's hard to find a lot of information on this. And what I wanted to find information on was, okay, obviously the mother is, you know, put under anesthesia. Apparently since this fetus is just a fetus and it has no feelings and, you know, it's just a fetus, apparently we can operate on it while it's still conscious and very much aware of what's going on. And I wasn't able to find anything on, you know, any concerns regarding the fact that they're operating on a baby, a gestating baby. That there's pictures that I found that are really disturbing of doctors doing these surgeries, and the little baby, their little tiny hand is grabbing onto the doctor's finger. they're very much aware of what's going on. I mean, talk about, you know, an alien abduction. You're being taken from, operated on, and oh, no, they don't feel anything. That's why they kick and move and respond to light. Oh, they don't feel anything. It's just a fetus.
Right. Ever, like, hear stories or talk to people who have sleep paralysis and a common, and it doesn't necessarily sound like grays or something, but a common nightmare and situation that they feel like they're in is that they see doctors with surgical masks peering over them and they can't move. So even if you're not being operated on as an infant, think about that's how you might be coming out into the world either way. And so somebody who has sleep paralysis experiences like that might kind of have an idea how terrifying that that situation of helplessness and coming out into that kind of environment could be for basically everybody who's ever born in a hospital. So think of it that way.
Yeah, it's just really bad and really unnecessary, and it's so troubling to me that, you know, your average person will think that, you know, they're doing the best thing for their baby. They want to have a safe baby or a healthy baby, a safe birth. And so they will think, oh, I have to go to the hospital because that's what, you know, the cultural norm is. And I'm neglecting my child if I don't go to the hospital. But it's so far from the truth. It's the complete opposite. And obviously people are starting to catch on. You know, this is moving in the right direction, but still the majority of young couples having children will give birth in the hospital or will be raped in the hospital, the better way of putting it. And they will, their son will be circumcised unless they explicitly state otherwise. And still sometimes it will happen against their will.
Yeah, or they'll forcibly retract the foreskin back when the mother isn't looking. So they'll disrupt the process of that on somebody who isn't circumcised. So either way, they're going to do some kind of bizarre damage to your son's genitals, essentially.
Yep, and probably to the woman's genitals as well with these episiotomies. And a lot of doctors, their policy is routine episiotomy. Even if even if things are going great, you know, the baby's crowning, everything's cool, they'll get those scissors out and cut because they got to do something, right? I mean, they're the doctor. They got to save the day. And just real quick about the doctors performing these procedures or, you know, this rape to babies and women and families. You know, it used to amaze me that these doctors are able to do this. And then I think about, okay, think about the kind of crap that the doctors have to go through in medical school to just become a resident, okay? It reminds me a lot of mind control, honestly, because they're sleep deprived. It's almost like hazing, you know, they have to be on call for weeks straight, you know, they have to sleep at the hospital and wake up on a moment's notice and be ready. And I think that sleep deprivation does a lot. And also they're so indoctrinated through, you know, the medical community and everybody agreeing on these crazy ideas that it just becomes normal. And I really believe that they convince themselves that birth is an emergency. It's a trauma, you know, to the woman and baby, and it injures them and it hurts them. And so when they really believe this, they're able to do these things because somewhere in their minds, they think that they're doing the right thing. And obviously not everyone's like that. I'm sure there are some doctors that are just sickos and they, you know, they go into this line of medicine to, you know, seek revenge or, I don't know, fulfill some kind of crazy psychological thing. But, a lot of doctors doing this, it's just so routine that they don't think anything other than this. And of course, when their ideas are challenged, they're very unreceptive to any kind of other input other than what their medical textbooks are saying.
Right. Even, and And when it comes down to it, as we've talked about on previous shows in regards to hysterectomy, which, funny, I'm reading this article and hysterectomy is spelled wrong, so that's why this article sucks. In general, how it was written, hysterectomies and cesareans are great ways to make money and to get babies out quicker. So when they're doing these, as you said, they always do a hysterectomy in conjunction with the if you want to call it fetal surgery on a baby in the uterus, because this isn't always true, but they say it is to get you in and out faster and charge you more, is that every time after you have a C-section baby, you're going to have to get cesareans every time after that. And what it says here, so there's that process. And then also in this article it says, however, there is no presented data suggesting that there is decreased fertility for the mother after these surgeries after having a hysterectomy. It's like, I think there is. When you remove ovaries and possibly even the cervix and, the things that require a woman to be fertile. I mean, this is just stupidity, honestly. That's written by these medical professionals, and they're just talking out of both sides of their mouth. It's just, God. And they don't even tell women what's removed. I will tell you this. There's a high rate of C-sections in my, or not C-sections, sorry, hysterectomies in my family because they grew really huge, painful fibroids, and, it's maybe getting some Rick Simpson oil or doing something helpful to combat free radicals. They just hack things out of you right away. So, my mom, for instance, had a hysterectomy only like a year or so after she had me, and they didn't even tell her which organs they removed. She doesn't even know what she has and doesn't have. Everything's very hidden and secretive. And they put you through all this and charge you a bunch of money and call it a day. And it's all good in their pocket. And then these people walk around not even really knowing what the hell happened to them. So.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah, it's that bad. I think with this fetal surgery and the, required hysterectomy after, I think they might just do a partial hysterectomy, which is taking out the cervix. I have no idea why, but I guess they would leave the ovaries because the woman could still get pregnant, yet I don't know how she would carry a pregnancy without a cervix.
Without a cervix, yeah. I've heard they stitch a cervix when a cervix is weak, but in that situation, do they stitch the muscular lining together or something?
Possibly.
Yeah, I don't even understand.
And then that's why they say subsequent babies would need to be born via cesarean, which I don't, it's not even being born. Actually, I wanted to share this little story that I heard. It's a real quick story, but it makes a point. So there are these little kids, and there are two cocoons with caterpillars inside of them. And so the first caterpillar, which is now a butterfly, emerging from the cocoon is, pushing his way out, and he's having a difficult time. But after a while of pushing through, he gets out of the cocoon and spreads his wings and he flies away. And the kids thought, man, that seemed really hard for that butterfly to get out. We should probably try and help the next one. So they cut into the cocoon and kind of helped the butterfly out. But the butterfly couldn't fly because he hadn't gone through that process. And I think the same exact thing goes for humans. Now, sometimes emergency C-sections can be life-saving, and that will leave a positive imprint on the family because, thank God. But this is happening too much because they're telling parents that, your baby's going to die because their breech. That happened to a woman that I had been speaking with about birth. A friend of mine knows my views on birth. She agrees with me, and she tries to get me to talk to her lady friends about it. And I don't have much luck, I've got to say. They don't listen to me. But it's sad because exactly what I, was warning her against, with hospital, they'll try and convince you need a C-section. Like, breech babies are normal. It's okay. They're not going to die. They basically you know, her baby was breech at the time. She was in labor, and they told her there are, you know, basically there's no chance that this baby will be able to be born vaginally. You know, you're just going to, the baby's going to die, or you're going to be ripped to shreds, you know, and so we got to do a C-section. And this is happening way too much. There's really not a lot of cases where a C-section is necessary, and it's being done way too much, and we don't realize the negative effect it's having on us. And that's just one aspect of it that needs to stop.
And there's so many simple solutions to that. I mean, without, you know, forcing your hand up into the birthing mother, you could have a doula or somebody who's a certified massage practitioner for laboring women in particular, go in and just externally on the belly sort of manipulate the baby around, and it'll kind of guide the baby, and they're like, oh, okay, you know, I could turn this way. Or up into the 70s, they would have acupuncturists come in and burn mugwort, moxibustion, on a point on the pinky toe, and without fail, babies always turn. Really simple stuff that could be done within, you know, 20 minutes. And and then you don't even have to fight, and everybody's going as it should be. So,
yeah.
But no, we want to turn this into a surgical event. The doctor gets hailed and extolled and charge you a bunch of money and put everybody in danger because, as you said, there are too many situations where it's just completely not necessary.
Really, really it is. And it's, yeah, I mean, even a breech baby in itself, I don't necessarily think even needs to turn. I think that we forget that babies are so intelligent. And, you know, they know just how to get out. And I think for some, you know, they feel best coming down foot first or butt first, you know. And I think that since birth has become so medicalized, people think of breech as, you know, a problem because the law has gotten in the way. In the state of Florida, where I am right now, if I were to be under the care of a midwife and my baby were breech and wouldn't turn, she'd have to say, sorry, I can't help you out anymore. I can't attend your birth. You've got to go have a C-section. And that's the law. So when the law is getting into people's personal lives, I mean, I know it is in so many different ways, but I mean, this is insane. And the same thing goes for past due, which is another kind of thing with birth trauma and just these crazy medical practices, is the induction of labor, which doesn't even really work at all. It just ends up, messing everything up. But I mean, the fact that, you know, they'll say this is the due date, you know, even though it's very hard to track where and when a person will give birth because everybody's different and people's dates aren't always right, you know. And an ultrasound, they think that, oh yeah, well, we did all these measurements, we know exactly how far along you are. No, that's not always the case. They're really just guessing. So here in this state, and I'm sure a bunch of other states, it's illegal, again, for a woman to go past 42 weeks. And if she's under a midwife's care, they'll say, sorry, I know, you know, we've built this relationship over the 9 months and, you know, you trusted me and you thought I was going to be there for you, but sorry, the law says I can't. And are they going to, you know, some midwives are badass and they don't give a crap and they will do it illegally and they will attend your birth. But, you know, some of these midwives that have their business and they got kids and they don't want to go to jail. I know I don't. They'll say, sorry, that's the law. You know, I have no power over the law. So then women are left to either be induced or, you know, just wait for it to happen naturally on their own. But the fact that we're inducing labors to begin with in any fashion, I don't care if it's herbally, you know, with castor oil, because that's the thing, you know, people will say, oh, well, you know, doctors give drugs to induce labor, but I've heard so many midwives that start a regimen of, you know, uterine contracting herbs or tinctures, or also, you know, taking evening primrose oil because it kind of mimics a prostaglandin, and they'll do like suppositories to ripen the cervix. And this is, you know, your holistic midwives telling women to do this. And again, it just me that they're not really trusting the process of birth to begin with, because you don't need to do anything, start labor. It'll happen. It's actually the baby that initiates labor by flooding the mother with hormones. So
right. I think those sort of steps would be like the herbs or certain points being palpated would be more helpful after the baby itself already initiated the process, but say perhaps otherwise the labor will take 2 days, because that does happen. When you're not in a hospital, you're allowed to take 2 days. But not everybody can deal with it for that long, and if they wanted to do something, say perhaps it's already been 15 hours, and, you know, baby already started 15 hours ago and started going. But to go in and try to force it to start at an unnatural time, I agree that's not necessary.
Yeah, it really is unnecessary. And I think, you know, I think a lot of the midwives do it because they don't, again, the stupid law is getting in the way, and they don't want to have to lose their clients. And I'm not saying that they're doing this because they're money hungry. I'm saying because they want to be able to attend these births without going to jail for the rest of their lives. So they'll try and push into labor. And it's messed up, but I understand where they're coming from because, you know, how awful is that to have to leave your, you know, your client hanging? And, you know, it's just the law that's getting in the way. You personally, you know, would be okay with it, but the law, they'll come and drag your butt to jail, you know, for doing nothing but waiting for a baby to come when a baby is supposed to come. And that's how ridiculous things are, and how the law has gotten so involved in our lives that there's no escaping it, really. They control every aspect of our lives, and you know, we're not a free country at all. I'd say America is one of the worst right now. I mean, we're one of the worst for infant mortality, and we're one of the most expensive countries to have a child in. A C-section can run $40,000, 40 grand for most of the time unnecessary major surgical procedure that damages women and their babies.
Absolutely insane.
It's
we're number one in Western countries for male circumcision, and also we have a passive female circumcision that people only attribute to third world Muslim countries usually, which isn't even true. So we have quite a spotted medical past tarnished, if you will.
Yeah, I had no idea about the female genital mutilation here in the United States until today when I was doing research. I knew that it went on in Africa because feminists are always bitching about the African women. You know, it really, if feminists are going to be all about women's rights and, you know, women, stand up for the women that were circumcised here, the white women, you know, the Christian women, as they might call themselves. But, you know, this wasn't some kind of Muslim practice. This was happening with white families. Their mothers would be there, and, you know, the pediatrician would recommend a circumcision of their daughter, and it would happen. For girls, it seems there are, like, four different levels of kinds of circumcision. And I just couldn't even really, like, look into all the different types. It was just really disgusting. But I know they're cutting something. And it kind of made me think about, you know, how we've talked about labiaplasty before. And the partner is kind of like cutting off their labia. I just think there's a connection there. I don't know. Maybe not. But it seems that...
I think so. Because what I understand from all these old medical journals is that not all cases, but many of them, were children who would be, I don't know, rubbing themselves, probably because it itched or was sensitive or irritated, because that's how that membrane works, and everybody sized differently. So some women, they're going to have larger clitoral hoods than labia, and it might get irritated from clothing, what have you. Also, we wear a lot of horrible synthetic fibers, so that's irritating. So, you know, these kids would, they were probably scratching more so than they were masturbating, as these medical journals labeled it as such. And that would be one of the primary causes for getting rid of the clitoris, and also downsizing the hood if that was large, because they didn't like the occult location of the clitoris underneath of larger hoods. They found that to be bothersome for some reason, I noticed over and over again. And with the labia, well, in third world countries, I think we talked about this before, they do infibulation, where they get rid of everything and they sew it up. So they were never that extreme here, but the fact that people are doing that now says a lot. And some women claim they get it done not so they look like the girls in porno, even though that's a lot of it these days. And a lot of these porn stars do get that done. They claim it's because they have longer labia minora and they feel irritated when they're running or with clothing. But there's other things you can do. You could keep that tissue supple by using coconut oil, vitamin E oil. There are things you could do to keep things soft. You could wear different clothing. There's a lot of options out there where clothes that are a little larger. I don't understand why we're all running around in super tight pants anyway. So there are things that can be done, but yeah, there's a definite connection there. Like, oh, it's too big and it rubs and it's out of place and I get rid of it, kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. There is no medical reason for a male or female to ever be circumcised. It's really ridiculous that they've been able to get away with this and people believing this. I mean, with the female genital mutilation, I'm not even going to call it circumcision, they would say that, my daughter's grinding her teeth. Oh, we need to circumcise. And then they would make some kind of study after saying, after I circumcised her, she stopped grinding her teeth and she just became the best person ever. You know, like any...
Is that for seizures, for colic? It was insane.
Yeah, anything. That's so... Oh, my God. Talk about how abusive. Your baby has colic. So they're all constant excruciating pain, which... Sorry, I just got a little sidetracked because colic, I think, is something else we could talk about. But, okay, this baby is in a lot of pain, and then you're going to go and genitally mutilate them to help out with that colic. Wow. We are so advanced. We are just, we are great. I mean, this is so, This is so bad. I hope that our children look back on, you know, we're looking back on this saying, holy crap, this is bad. But I hope, you know, the future generations just look back and we are just pathetic examples of a society, because that's really what I see. And I hope this doesn't, you know, keep going on any longer, because it's just so insane. And this is damaging so many people. And now, it was not until 1996 that female genital mutilation was completely outlawed, from what I can see. Now,
And some of the medical journals that we were looking at, they were as recent as 1958 that they were doing these surgeries for grinding teeth and just stupid excuses. And then people wonder why, like, the 50s were so sexually repressive in that way, and you would always hear the stereotype or hear from old journals that, oh, man, these housewives are really miserable. And it's not to say that being a housewife is awful, but maybe given a lot of the lies that were constructed around the greatest generation, baby boomers, kind of their parents and such. And then given that not only were the men circumcised, but also the women, everybody was mutilated and kind of made into eunuchs, basically. So,
yeah. Or the mothers, you know, giving birth to those babies that were soon to be mutilated, they were put on, you know, scopolamine.
Yeah. The twilight sleep.
Twilight sleep, where they were strapped down to their hospital bed because they were violently having seizures or hallucinating. Scopolamine apparently is similar to this drug called Devil's Breath. I don't know, some people might have seen this Vice documentary that they did about it. But basically, if someone is given scopolamine, they're highly, highly suggestible, and they'll do basically anything you tell them to. So you could say, okay, I need you to go rob this bank for me, and they would go do it. So... That's what we were giving to laboring mothers and, you know, pumping them full of drugs. And then we wonder why all these babies grow up to be drug addicts, because they're born drugged. They're born in a drug-induced state. And, okay, they're giving these full dosages to grown women. Okay, this passes the placental barrier, and so it drugs the baby 20 times more than the mother, because it's a baby and the mother's a lot bigger.
So right, and then they come down on somebody for, like, I don't know, having an occasional hit of a cannabis or something, just periodically through their pregnancy, and they're like, oh my God, you're a murderer. And but then yet they can just drug them out of this world while they're coming into the world, and they could have had a completely drug-free, very healthy pregnancy, but then they, out of the same mouth, can say and do that. So.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That just shows you the ridiculous double standard there is. And, yeah, it's really, really scary. And, okay, so they used to do scopolamine back then. Now, today, we're doing Cytotec and Cervidil, which Cervidil, I found out, this is what they will give women. Okay, so say a woman's waters release, or her water breaks, as some people like to call it. She is given a timeline after that happens to when she needs to go into labor until they're going to have to induce her. Now, a lot of times they'll scare women and tell them, okay, well, your water bags have opened. Now, if that baby doesn't come out, it's going to shrivel and dry up and get infected. But what they're not telling women, and what women don't know, because a lot of us don't know anything about our bodies or birth because we've been lied to, what will happen is that the membranes, the amniotic sac, can actually reseal itself. And if a woman drinks enough water and she keeps everything out of there that would cause infection, fingers, things, you know, nothing up there, it'll be fine. And mothers have waited, you know, 3 days after their water's release, and their baby is born just fine. But they'll tell women in a hospital setting that, you know, okay, your waters have released and you haven't gone into labor yet, so we're going to need to induce your labor. And this is not the only time they will tell women they need to induce their labor. It could be women actually demanding to be induced because, you know, their husband is home from Iraq or something, and, you know, she wants him to see the baby be born. Or it could be, I have a wedding to go to in a month and I don't want to have this baby bump anymore. I mean, real selfish reasons that women will do this. And then it could also be, again, just she's gone a day past her due date or a week past her due date, which is, oh my God, this magical number, this magical date. So then they'll say, yeah, you know, the baby, I really don't know what they even tell women. What are they going to tell them? You know, that baby needs to come out today. You know, one day over is just going to kill that baby. Obviously, the baby's not ready to come out yet if they haven't initiated labor. So what they'll do...
Yeah, they got to cook.
Exactly. What they'll do is they'll start with this Cervidil, which is a prostaglandin. We find prostaglandins in male semen and also animal semen. So what does our great medical community do? They take pig and bull semen, and put it into suppositories for women to insert vaginally.
Wait, what?
Yes, this is pig and bull semen, animal semen, that they are giving to women to insert into their vaginas to ripen the cervix. Okay.
And that's not going to cause infection or anything to
exactly.
go awry? Like, that's disgusting. That's
exactly.
disgusting. Sorry.
This is the first I'm hearing
of this, so I'm having a reaction here.
It's really awful.
Bestiality a little bit and unsanitary.
See,
and oh, my God.
I think this hospital birth has many different levels. It's like an agenda that has many different levels to it. I really think a lot of this is completely insidious, and it's meant to alter our species in a drastic way. I think there are certain people that crafted this in a very intricate way, and they know exactly what they're doing. And I think the doctors are just basically following orders, but there is a big plan here. I don't want to, I know Janice Barcello, we were talking about her work earlier because I agree with a lot of it, but she always calls it satanic. You know, there's some, I do believe that a lot of this hospital birth is kind of like some kind of weird ritual, you know, with the woman being on the table, like an altar and all, you know, weird stuff like that. But I don't want to just call it satanic because that's stupid. You can't prove. Oh,
I think it's detracting from what it actually is, which is dark Semiticism.
Yes, that's a much better way of putting it, because when you're calling it satanic, you're still playing into that dichotomy of, you know, good God, evil Satan, you know, and it's like you're falling into that trap.
And she even mentioned what the Moles do in her one interview, and then the people that she was interviewing, who were great, they were awesome, they really didn't address that either. People really skate around the origin where a lot of this is happening, and a lot of it does involve blood and body parts, and now we're saying animal semen. Like, holy shit, come on, like, look at, like, this is a gestalt level. Like, where is it coming from, and what does it all mean when you lay everything out piece by piece and look at it? And it's just, it's disturbing to me that we go from, okay, we live in a world where now all this is happening, even people that know this is happening are detracting from why it's happening, but once upon a time, like, okay, I found this. This is what used to be done to those who broke laws and practiced circumcision in the ancient world. Here's an example. In 167 BCE, Judea was part of the Seleucid Empire. Its ruler, Antiochus, 175 to 165, defeated in battle against Egypt and banned traditional religious practice of circumcision. And what would be done is, as part of the punishment for those who broke these laws, is that people who practice circumcision, whether Jewish or not, would have to go to the temple of Zeus. And these Jews were ordered, under the threat of execution, to sacrifice pigs, because they were unkosher, to Greek gods. And any other unkosher animals that were in Jewish scriptures. This decree outlawed circumcision, and the parents who violated this order were hanged along with their infants. Okay, that's hardcore, but it tells you, we go from this to allowing them to mutilate them and put bull semen in our women.
Yes, and mutilate our own children. We've given them up to this Judaic system. And I was talking to my mom today on the phone. She was a midwife in the UK and grew up in Ireland. And she was telling me that she's like, none of our boys were circumcised. None of my brothers were circumcised. I never, you know, witnessed a circumcision when I was attending a birth. Now that might have changed, you know, today, that might be happening in hospitals in the UK and Ireland. I wouldn't be surprised, but this really does seem central to the United States of America. We've really gotten the brunt of this hospitalized trauma. It's really deep and dark, and there's a lot of other things I want to get into, but with the Cervidil, this is really important that we get this out, because there is some kind of weird ritual being performed here with inserting bull or pig semen into a woman to ripen her cervix, which is just so stupid. And then, of course, that doesn't work, right? That doesn't work to bring on labor. Because even if you are ripening a woman's cervix, doesn't mean she's going to go into labor. She'll go into labor when she's going to go into labor.
Because we know, well, first of all, it's disgusting. The aspect of also the pig semen being there, that kind of to me screams, ugh. Let's take this unkosher animal semen, you know, give it to these goyim. Yeah, I mean, that's real sick. But, I mean, looking at it energetically and medicinally, you know, people eat bull testicles, but people who eat bull testicles are men who are trying to gain testosterone. Why would you give something that's really young and full of testosterone to a woman who's in labor, who's in an estrogenic state?
Yes.
That makes no sense. That's just so stupid. And I know, even as you said, like, it's not the best to initiate a labor when the baby isn't ready. The evening primrose oil is a really feminine herb. A lot of these salves at least make sense estrogenically. Like, it's just to be sick.
Exactly. And if a woman was at home in the comfort of her bedroom with her husband, lover, partner, they could have sex. His semen, the semen that created the baby, could soften and ripen her cervix. Or, you know, nipple stimulation also can induce contractions or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to feel very sexy in a hospital with your hospital gown on, which makes you look like an unhealthy, ER patient, and bright lights and strangers walking in and out of the room. That's not a very sexy, intimate place, if you ask me. And birth is intimate and sexual. So, yeah, that's the last place I would want to be intimate with anyone is in a frickin' hospital. But, so after they do this whole Cervidil thing with the animal semen, they're like, okay, well, this isn't doing anything. Your body's just not working right. So, we're going to have to start you on a Pitocin drip, which is they'll start intravenously. And Pitocin, I know I talked about it before, and I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself, but this stuff is so important, and I hope that, you know, maybe someone didn't hear it before, so I'll repeat it again. Because this probably happened to one of your mothers. This might have been your birth. You might have been a Pitocin-induced baby. I mean, we've all been through these really terrible experiences, and we need to heal from them. So, sorry, but Pitocin is synthetic oxytocin. And obviously oxytocin is what the baby releases and the mother releases to initiate labor. The uterus has the most oxytocin receptors in the whole entire body. So this is very much about labor, about birth, about bonding and love. This is a love hormone. So, you know, instead of letting those hormones, those real authentic hormones release naturally in their own time, we're saying, no, we got to give you synthetic oxytocin. So this usually will bring on really, really intense, painful contractions that are back-to-back, usually with, you know, pressure waves or contractions, whatever people like to use. They come, they peak, they subside, and then you have a break. It's kind of like riding waves. But with Pitocin right away, it hasn't slowly increased and they're getting closer together. No, it's boom, 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 right on top of the other really intense, painful contractions. And I think this is why a lot of men that I've talked to will say, well, oh, you're always saying labor isn't painful. Well, why don't you talk to my wife about that? And I'm saying, look, I am not denying the fact that people have experienced a lot of pain. I will never try and say that no one has experienced pain because I can't say that. I haven't been in their body. But I think when our hormones are allowed to release naturally, oxytocin is the natural painkiller, and we have natural painkillers that release within our bodies when we're allowed to have those hormones flow in a natural way. But when we're not, and when we're induced with synthetic oxytocin, yeah, it's going to be painful. And I think that's why a lot of women have experienced really painful births. You know, because of this fake oxytocin that they're injecting into women. And even if you get through your labor without needing to be induced, at the very end, you know, the baby's been born, they'll clamp the cord right away, which is another thing we should talk about. There's so much. But they'll give women a shot of Pitocin in the leg after the baby's born because they say, we got to get that placenta out right away and we got to give you this Pitocin so you don't hemorrhage. So they'll just shoot the woman in the leg with Pitocin right after she's given birth, and she's going to have painful contractions for hours after. Instead of just letting the placenta come out 10, 20, half hour later, and everything's cool. You know, it's like everything has to be rushed and messed with in the hospital. It's really bad. And with the umbilical cord, what they're doing is, you know, a lot of hospitals will say, oh, yeah, we're all about natural birth because people are becoming hip to this now, you know. They say, hey, I want a natural birth. I've heard all these scary things that are happening, and I want a natural birth. And the hospital will say, oh, yes, we are totally on board with that. We are all about natural birth. We do delayed cord clamping, which they do, but for them, delayed cord clamping is maybe a minute, 30 seconds. The baby the baby has one-third of their blood supply that is still being pumped into them, and that cord is usually clamped right away and cut. And that cord hasn't stopped pulsating. The baby hasn't had all of the blood transfer into their body, so they're being born anemic. Also, a lot of the times babies aren't breathing right away with their lungs after they come out of the womb because they're still receiving oxygen through the umbilical cord. So if they're still receiving oxygen through the umbilical cord and it's clamped and cut right away, they're going to experience asphyxiation. It's going to be like they can't breathe. So again, this is another wonderful procedure that I really think is done strategically. Maybe not everybody knows why it's done, but I think that they're trying to do everything they can possibly do to mess with babies on the first day and before they're even born, because this sets up the perfect slave race that is traumatized severely, that will start to develop deviant behaviors. I think there's a correlation. I haven't found any studies or anything, but just in thinking, I really do think there's a correlation between the, you know, circumcision and homosexuality. Obviously, there's a lot of homosexual programming being, you know, shoved down our throats, but I really do think that men have found more comfort in each other because they're not able to open up around women, maybe. And this is obviously just a certain population of men. I'm not saying if you're circumcised or gay or anything. But
right.
And we do know that there's a correlation between circumcision. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. So make your point. You're halfway through. So.
Yep, I'm done.
Oh, okay. So real quick, before I make another point, about the cord cutting, traditionally, even in American hospitals, they would have the father. They would say, "You want to cut the cord and do the honor?"
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty scary too. Like, oh, they have the father help make that kid cut off its blood supply or an air supply. And with deviant behavior, or perhaps just some kind of mental disturbance, personality problems. When there is an oxygen to the brain doesn't work very well. So
right.
If you're doing that early on in their life, what kind of stepping stone is that into life? That's pretty bad. I was blue, and they put me in an incubator, and they probably wouldn't have had to do that if they didn't probably cut the cord really fast. So that's a lot, you know. But about circumcision, this is coming from Janice Barcelo, who, as we said, does some really great stuff. We just have a disagreement as to who the main enemy is there. This is stuff I never thought about. She was saying that men, when they are circumcised, they lose their main oxytocin receptor. So when they are making love with women, they aren't able to connect as much. And physiologically, the place where they're going to feel the most pleasure is going to be at the penile frenulum underneath, at the, you know, the top of the shaft and underneath the head. And that influences them to kind of go sort of hard and fast. And to me, that ties in really easily with how things are portrayed as normal in pornography, because they, first of all, it's callousness, just like the gland on their body. It's not being influenced by oxytocin. That's been stripped away from them, literally. And it's something that becomes really relatable to men. And because look what's been done to their body and internally their soul that's been stripped from them. So it's a really scary setup when I look at it that way, in conjunction with what we've covered before with porn and culture. And then she's saying this, that's scary. And I worry about all the men and boys out there that is, and I was anyway, but that just adds another level of disturbance to it, really. And you wonder why our family systems are so broken, and not even families, just people trying to have healthy relationships.
Yeah, yeah. It's really bad. It's really bad. You know, that's the first day of a boy's life. Experience of sex and violence, and we wonder, you know, we wonder why are men the way they are, and you know, oh, you know, feminists always going on about rape culture, but I'm going to circumcise my son because he's a rapist and I don't want him to have any sexual pleasure. I mean, I saw on your blog, which I love your blog, by the way, I look at it like every day.
Thanks.
Yeah. You had this thing up there about, you know, this is feminism and all of these just really disturbing things that feminists have written. And I saw, you know, multiple things from mothers of baby boys that are saying, you know, ugh, I'm actually kind of upset it's a boy, but since it is, I'm going to have him circumcised so all of his sexual pleasure is taken away. I mean, really, you should not be having children. You are a sick, sick person.
Yeah.
To do that to
it's absolutely disgusting.
Oh, my God. And it really does, it messes with all of us. You know, men and women's relationships really do suffer.
They absolutely do.
A lot of times,
they're not even on the same page, as I said, physiologically, because what they do to men's bodies, it doesn't even correlate with how women's bodies function in that situation. And it, I've heard of this before, that because the foreskin's been removed, it removes all the when you pull yourself in and out, I guess. It takes the fluid out of the woman's body. And I've read this before for people that are restoring their foreskins, that after they restored it, the women in their lives said that it hurts less, doesn't cause abrasion. It's just really sick that it's been set up that we're literally in the process of making love, hurting each other, not coordinating. It severs connection in a lot of ways.
It really does. It really does. And that's why there are so many sexually unsatisfied people. And,
yeah.
You know, back in like the 50s or 60s, they would call, you know, women frigid that didn't want to have sex. And I think a lot of the times it was painful for women, and they didn't, none of us had or have really any language to discuss these things, because, you know, women like my grandmother would just not even know that there's anything other than a circumcised penis, really, you know, because that's just everybody, that was the thing. And, you know, if you don't like having sex with your husband because it hurts, well, you can't say that because, you know, nobody else is saying it, you know, and you're weird for not liking it. But I think a lot of times maybe women might not be interested in sex as much as their partner would like. Maybe because of that reason. And, you know, maybe not a language for us to use with each other yet, you know, about that. And, it's just, I mean, we're the country that buys the most lubricants, which are toxic, and we're putting them in our genitals, you know, because of this issue of, you know, the fluid being pulled out.
And I've had friends who say, well, that's pretty messed up, but will women get more UTIs if they're having unprotected sex with an uncircumcised man? And the answer is no, for one thing. And the solution is even people will say, well, yeah, and if that does happen anyway, you can take an antibiotic. Well, those are horrible, really, honestly. Well, knowing that the lubricants are terrible, you could use something like aloe or coconut oil or something, which kills microbes and bacteria, so it'll keep balance in the female's body no matter what the status is of her lover's foreskin, and lubricate and kind of be an overall solution to these sorts of things that people worry about. We live in a really sick and fucked up world, and it takes years to restore foreskin. So In the meantime, come up with creative solutions. We can work around these things, and we can work with each other. And as you said, we just need to find a language and an outlet to even speak about these things and figure out how to go about making things work as best as we can, given the cards that we've been given.
Well said. Well said. And I just think it's so stupid that we think that, oh, well, this boy is not going to know how to clean his penis. I mean, we better cut that skin off because, I mean, women have more, UTIs than men. And, are we, obviously not anymore, but are we circumcising girls for these reasons? No, not as of 96, apparently, but, we're using the same outdated reasons for genitally mutilating boys. Treating them like freaking retards that don't know how to clean themselves. Okay, if you know how to use a bar of soap, you're gonna be fine with your foreskin. Okay, we handle it just fine as women. We keep ourselves clean. It's really not difficult at all, and it's just so silly to me that a parent will even give that argument. They'll say, "Oh well, I don't want my son to get a UTI," or, I mean, is that really the end of the world? Girls get UTIs all the time, and they drink some cranberry juice, and it's gone. So, I mean, this is the only, thing that we perform surgery on to prevent things from happening. There is no other surgery that we do say, oh, well, we're going to have to take out your sinuses because you might get a sinus infection. No, we don't do that because that's stupid. And circumcision is really stupid.
Absolutely. And really, as I said earlier, there are plenty of European countries where this just really isn't done. As you said, Ireland. I know that there was some controversy about getting rid of it in Germany, and a lot of people were saying, oh, my God, but it's so anti-Semitic. And Denmark recently has been trying to they're working to ban circumcision. And this is funny. Hold on, let me find the little quote. There's a where is it? Oh, okay. Northern Europe, which has no tradition of routine circumcision, has struggled with challenges of its Jewish and Muslim minorities. Finland is considering legislation to legalize male circumcision. Sweden, in 2001, passed a law requiring traditional circumcisers to be certified for infants to be given medically administered anesthetic. So basically, they're allowing it. But the World Jewish Congress says that this is the first legal restriction placed on the Jewish right in Europe since the Nazi era. So.
Oh, God.
They're still going to bitch, so.
Yeah,
that's what? But they keep the bans coming.
It's anti-Semitic to not let us mutilate and suck on our little baby boys' bloody penises. That's anti-Semitic.
Boy,
they. Oh, my God. It's so sick. It's so sick. And parents are, they're handing their babies over to be ritually mutilated in some kind of Jewish ceremony in the hospital. And then they'll say, oh, well, I did it for my covenant with Jehovah or some kind of bullshit. I've argued with mothers on forums for, I think this lady was even a doula. And she's like, my husband thanks his parents every day for keeping the covenant with Jehovah through his circumcision, and both of our sons have this covenant with Jehovah. And I had to leave the forum because I couldn't even, how do you even argue or talk to somebody that sick? It's not even stupid, and it's really mentally sick. I mean, real sick.
And there's other weird things people will say, like, well, but he wants his son to look like him. Like, why do you have to have twinsy dicks? That's
exactly
what?
That's not creepy self. Oh well, I don't want him to be made fun of. Wow, you're a friggin' idiot. So okay, I'm gonna let my child, be mutilated because they might be made fun of by the other traumatized mutilated victims. No, that is not a reason. And you know what? this needs to be outlawed, and parents should not be able to bring a child into this world that they are going to hand over and let them be mutilated. I'm sorry, that's child abuse, and you do not deserve to have a child if you're going to allow that to happen to your child for any of the stupid reasons that you give. I have no respect for parents that do this to their children. I really don't. I lose all respect for them when I show them information and they say, we're going to do it anyways. I'm like, you're a sick person.
Yeah, my dad was kind of floored when I told him about the moles. He went, okay, that's pretty fucking weird. But despite my mom overhearing this as well, she's still like, but they're going to get UTIs, and oh my God, you have to circumcise, and it's going to be a battle when the day comes when I have kids that she's going to be like, why are they circumcised? It's ugh, no, I'll just hide them from her until they're grown out of diaper age. So be like, oh, yeah, you'll never know. Because I'm not dealing with that, you know?
Oh, well,
I mean,
you know what?
It's ridiculous that people still buy into that. It's like, come on, blood sucking. Like, do I have to tell you anything else? Like, what is going to convince you?
What are grandparents' concerns about their grandchildren's genitalia in the first place? Why are they even talking about it? Why do they even care?
No, it's weird. It's really fucking weird.
Weird. Oh, well, let me inspect your baby's genitalia to make sure it's been mutilated. No, honestly, I would say keep your kids away from your mom, honestly, if she's going to be like that. You got to, like, hide them away.
Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid she'll, like, take them off and, like, get them vaccines.
That is really scary. And there, you know what?
Yeah.
There are a lot of people I've heard like that, you know, that especially, like with my family, you know, like my aunts and uncles, grandma, they don't agree with my outlook on things. But I've got to say, they never try and convince me otherwise. They'll say, like, I don't agree, but they never, you know, will try and force me into their way of thinking, which I respect that. We have boundaries, you know, but some family members do not know boundaries, and they will call the cops on parents for not, you know, birthing in a hospital on their own,
own
son-in-law or daughter-in-law. They'll call the ambulance. They'll call, you know, and report them for not vaccinating. I mean, they'll call every day and harass the woman. It's really that bad. I mean, our own family members are policing us. Now, obviously, in my case, that's not happening, but, you know, in a lot of people's situations, that is happening. Their own family is turning against them and trying to get them basically initiated into this huge cult, this huge Jewish cult of abuse, ritual abuse, and severe trauma, which then is turned into mind control. It's so deep. I guess another thing I wanted to talk about were these internal fetal heart monitors that I don't know if a lot of people know about. But basically, after a woman has been induced, you know, the baby – actually, you know what? I found this out today. There's a procedure in hospitals called induce or Pitocin to distress. Okay, so the doctor will tell the nurse, we need to do a Pitocin to distress. Basically, what they're saying is they're going to keep, you know, flooding the IV of Pitocin until the baby goes into distress, and then they need to do a C-section. This is hospital protocol, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We want to put that baby in distress so we can do a C-section. This is hospital protocol. No one seems to be questioning it, really, that's working in the hospitals. They got to keep their job, right? So
and it doesn't help that they train them on plastic pregnant dolls that have, like, a little baby that comes out that you pull out.
Yep. Yeah, I've seen those.
Yeah.
Aren't they just,
it's like, what do you expect? They're completely disconnected. So when these things come down to it, they just view that woman and that child in there as these dolls. They're like, oh, yeah, it's just like the dummies in class, you know, cause distress. It doesn't matter. They're not real. They don't matter.
Hex. Exactly. Yep. It's so removed from anything humane. That woman is not a woman. She's a vagina with her legs up in stirrups. They'll cover everything except for the opening of her vagina, and the baby is a fetus. It's not a baby. It's a fetus. So yeah, with these internal fetal heart monitors, usually when the baby has gone into distress, they have to make sure they keep track of the heart rate of the baby, because that baby is being drugged and they are in distress and the mother's in distress and it's a bad situation. So what do? To make the situation better? They take an internal fetal heart monitor, which screws into the soft part of the baby's head while they're in utero. They screw in a monitor into the baby's head.
Wow.
Into their head. I think there is something really, obviously this is disgusting and traumatic, but I think
don't
there's
they
something.
Say, like, oh, you have to be careful with the fontanelle and how you position them sleeping and holding them, but we're going to put a screw in their head.
Screw into the tops of their head. And I heard, you know, sometimes Janice says some crazy stuff. Gotta love it. But she did say something today that sounded a little out there, but it made sense to me. And she was saying that, you know, at the time of birth, a baby is basically downloading information from the divine, from the other realms, that it's taking with them and bringing into this new realm. And I really do think that obviously screwing something into the baby's head is going to mess with just everything in general, but I really think that that is chosen specifically for that reason. That
well, right
just,
at the fontanelle where they're probably screwing in because it's soft is a point called GV20, and it's called meeting of 1,000 meetings. So if you're thinking about a baby's downloading information from something divine, why would it not download into a place where there are thousands of things going in? And the first places to develop on a baby are the points between the anus and the urogenital tract, and also the top of the head. And then consequently, you get the front meridian down the front of the body, and then the meridian running down the back of the body, which is the gateway to all of their life force and all their energy in their little body before it branches out everywhere else. So she is completely on point, and it speaks volumes that they're sticking a screw into that part of that child's head.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's something big there.
Yeah.
Cool VR guy, actually, I did look at the chat. I know I wasn't supposed to do it, but I glanced over, and I guess there's this app on people's phones that you can listen to the baby's heartbeat. That is really not safe looking. I say get a fetoscope, which is it's a stethoscope. You put the things in your ear, and it's like a little kind of horn-shaped thing. Press it up to your stomach, and you can hear the baby's heartbeat. And honestly, since birth is not a medical event, I don't know why everyone is checking the heartbeat during labor. The baby's heartbeat does deaccelerate during birth to facilitate them passing through the birth canal. That doesn't mean that the baby is in distress or that it's an emergency. I understand listening to, you know, after like 20, 30 weeks, finding the heartbeat, and that's just such a cool experience, and you can connect with your baby on that level. But I don't understand why we're constantly monitoring fetal heart tones. It's unnecessary, in my opinion.
And isn't there going to be a spike in the heart rate when they're coming into the world? I mean, don't they feel changes in their mother's body? They know they're going on an adventure into a new realm. Like, that's exciting. Like, when you're excited about something, your heart rate speeds up. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I even see, you know, home birth midwives with the Doppler there, you know, rubbing gel on the woman's stomach as the baby is crowning, listening to the heartbeat. It's like, why? The baby is coming out. Why are you checking their heartbeat right now? Everything's going fine. Just let it happen. You know, it's crazy. But yeah, so I wanted to mention those internal fetal heart monitors because it's just disgusting. And then we have the cord clamping. Okay, another note I had written down here was how a shoulder dystocia, which is a medical term for a baby's shoulders getting stuck on various parts of the woman's pelvis. Now, I honestly think this is a modern invention thanks to medical intervention of birth. Because if a woman is not laying on her back with her pelvic open closed and being told and directed when to push which, you know, we've talked about this before. Pushing is not always even necessary in a birth. There's the fetal ejection reflex, and there's also just breathing the baby out through pressure waves or contractions, and the baby comes out with each pressure wave or contraction. But they're telling people, they're directing women to push, telling them, okay, push, 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 okay, stop, push, push, push. So again, she's passive. She's not active in her role as a birthing woman. She's being told what to do. But okay, say a baby's shoulders get stuck. Instead of flipping her over, saying, you know, or instead of leaving her alone in the first place and having her birth that baby however she feels comfortable instead of laying on her back, now doctors, this is what they're teaching doctors to do. They're teaching doctors to break babies' bones so they can get them out. They'll teach them how to break the clavicle so they can get the baby out. And you know what their excuse for this is? They say that women are too fat and they're making their babies too big, so they need to learn how to break the bones to get them out. Instead of seeing the fact that lying on your back is not going to open the birth canal. It's not going to open the pelvis. This is retarded. But no, instead of correcting that very obvious problem by having the woman go on all fours, by having the woman get into whatever position she needs to, no, they'll say, we need to break the baby's bones to get them out. So again, welcome to the world. We just broke your bone. And oh, you're not going to get any pain meds either because you're a baby. We might kill you with the pain meds, but we'll slice your foreskin off. We'll break your bones. We'll do surgery to you while you're in the womb, but we can't give you any pain meds, okay? Because we don't want to kill you. We're just trying to look out for you. I mean, oh, it does my head in. Am I still connected to the call? I'm sorry, I went on a rant there.
No, it's okay. I was just scowling at the idea of them breaking, like, a little shoulder bone like that.
Yes.
Instead of, I don't know, doing something practical, relying on gravity, you know, crouch or something.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, great, you know.
Yep, and then
I don't know, maybe if they had doulas or other certified practitioners along with the woman, or she's at home with these practitioners, they could work her pelvic floor muscles with her or her hip flexors, and they could maybe release a little bit of space or work around the sacrum to open that entire portion of the lower body while she's crouching or using a birthing chair, and then maybe the baby would go through with a lot more ease.
Yeah, I honestly think shoulder dystocia is an invention. Same thing with cephalopelvic disproportion or whatever it's called, CPD, which is basically them telling women before they even have a kid, your pelvis is too small. I mean, okay, if these people are calling themselves medical professionals, maybe you should know how the pelvis works. Maybe. I mean, maybe you think you might even look into that a little bit. The pelvis is beautifully designed to birth babies. Small women, large women. You know, just because women have wide hips doesn't mean that they're going to give birth any better than a woman with tiny hips. It really does not matter. It's the pelvis. The pelvis opens up. The hormones relaxing allow for the pelvic to stretch, the ligaments to stretch, for everything to open. That's why women have a lot more relaxing in their body in the last months of pregnancy, and sometimes they can, you know, get injured more easily because everything's flimsy. No, the pelvis is designed perfectly to birth a baby. I mean, do we measure their pelvis? Do we measure a cow's pelvis or, you know, their birth canal? No, they seem to give birth just...
Right, and that's why women get, like, lordosis, because all those ligaments are moving and her lower spine moves back to create more room in that area. I mean, all these things, they don't happen by accident. It's ridiculous. You're right, yeah. They don't look at a cow that way. They just understand that nature will take its course and everything will be fine.
Yep. Exactly. So I just wanted to put out the phone number if anyone wants to call in and add anything. Such a big topic, and I'm sure, you know, all of us, especially here in the United States, I'm sure we all have, you know, some kind of crazy story to tell about our entrance into this world, and that stays with us. I really think it does, and I'm just, you know, recently starting to look into my birth and just trying to put the pieces together, you know, trying to make sense of why I was the way I was, why I do some of the things I do, because I really do think it goes right back to our first experiences, and that leaves an imprint, and that's why, you know, maybe I can read a little bit of this. I don't even know if I said the phone number. I'm sorry. I'm all over the place. The phone number is 347-633-9657. If you'd like to call and join the discussion. But maybe I can read just a little bit of this thing about the limbic imprint. Mm-hmm. It's kind of long, so I'll just read a bit. Why is it critical for us to understand the importance of healthy, happy gestation and birth? Why is it important to make every effort to eliminate the birth trauma from the delivery room? Is it affecting us? How? Well, it does affect us in a very big way. The new baby, way before the birthday, during it, and right after, is an extremely sensitive being. In fact, more sensitive than he or she will ever be during their entire adult life. Not able to have all of those sensations and feelings, but also not cognitively able to remember them. Our early impressions stay with us for the rest of our lives, for better or for worse. 25 years of thorough research and studies in the field of prenatal psychology show undoubtedly a direct correlation between the way we were born and the subconscious behavioral and emotional patterns in our adult lives. This is due to the mechanism called the limbic imprint. We are very familiar with establishing the basic settings on our TVs, cameras, computers. Imagine that your TV is set on maximum blue. Then no matter what movie is being shown on the screen, everything will be very blue. Or if the brightness is set on dim, same thing. No matter how bright the image is in the video, your screen will show a very dark picture. The exact mechanism is at work with us mammals. It's the same limbic imprint that is being deliberately used for thousands of years to train animals to serve people, elephants, camels, horses, circus bears. For example, a baby elephant is routinely tied in the yard to a chain and a small stick in the ground. The baby elephant engages all his might for a few days and then stops. When he grows up and has enough strength to pull the stick out, it doesn't happen. He never even tries. It's kind of like learned helplessness, and I think a lot of people in this country and all over are, you know, experiencing learned helplessness. To better understand the limbic imprint, let's look at the basic structure of the brain. At the tip of the spinal cord, there is a segment called the reptilian brain, responsible purely for the physiological functions of the body. That's the part of the brain that still remains functional when a person is in a coma, for example, in a vegetative state. The basic physiology of the body is still going on. Women even keep menstruating and continue with gestation if they are pregnant. I've even known of women in comas giving birth, so that just shows you that this is a physiological process that will take place, whether you like it or not, it's going to happen. Babies come out. Then there is the cortex, usually referred to as gray matter, responsible for our mental activity. That's what we routinely call the brain, the part of the brain responsible for our cognitive functions, logic, calculating, planning. And then we have the limbic system of the brain, responsible for our emotions, sensations, and feelings. Limbic imprinting happens in that part of the brain, which is not directly connected with the cortex responsible for cognitive memory. During gestation, birth, and early childhood, the limbic system registers all of our sensations and feelings without translating them into language, simply because it's not developed yet. That memory lives in the body through the rest of our life. We come into this world wide open to receive love. When we do receive it as our first primal experience, our nervous system is limbically imprinted or programmed with the undeniable rightness of being held in the mother's loving arms. Feeding from her breast and seeing the joy in father's eyes provides us with a natural sense of bliss and security. It sets the world as the right place for us to be in. If our first impressions of being in the body are anything less than loving, painful, frightening, lonely, then that anything imprints as a valid experience of love. It is immediately coded into our nervous system as comfort zone, acting as a surrogate for the love and nurturing, regardless of how painful, frustrating, and undesirable it actually was. And in the future adults, we will unconsciously, automatically recreate the conditions that were imprinted at birth and through our early childhood. It goes on, but that pretty much sums up, what I was trying to get at. This is why we're seeing so much degeneracy. This is why we're seeing so much violence, just utter chaos, and disharmony because this limbic imprint has been going on for so long. Generations and generations and generations of trauma that keeps snowballing and getting worse and worse and worse. And there are a select few of us that are changing that genetic imprint. And I think that we have a big job to do, and we have a lot of power because this is a powerful choice to make, to change things for the better and to stop the vicious cycle. And I think that, once more generations are born into the world in a loving way, we're going to see an amazing transformation of our earth and, of everything around us. Now we need to get rid of certain elements, obviously, for that to happen more easily. But I think this is a big key in changing the very state of things, around us.
Yeah, definitely. So, there's no accident that people will sometimes have the same dreams, even down family lines or things like that, because they're all interconnected. So with that being said, exactly as you were reading, we're literally, I think, we carry those little bits of every generation behind us as we're born into the world. And
yeah.
And it takes so much work to undo that. And it really takes a lot of audacity to even, sit there and look at it, for one thing, admit what's happening, instead of just living in La La Land, Walmart, and football games or what have you here. That it can be frightening at first. It could be enraging. There's a lot of things that people are gonna experience on an emotional level, and perhaps even a physical level, just looking back and understanding why they are the way they are, why their parents are the way they are, and their grandparents. They have knowledge that goes back further, those generations as well. And we have to know that in our core that we can make our own lives better, and that we can make the lives better for the generations ahead. And there isn't any reason that we can't. We just have to stay on course. We can't give up, and we can't divert. And it's going to be tiring, and it's going to be taxing. But this is your life, and knowing that you're here now, and that you're going to carry on your lineage, you can't let that fall for those ahead of you, because we know how much we're struggling now, because everyone behind us, it's not to point fingers, because there are bigger factors as to why they are and why things even panned out the way that they did. But sometimes you look at that and you feel let down a little bit. And doesn't mean, I'm just going to be apathetic and I'm not going to change things for those ahead of me. And no, too many people do that. Too many people think, well, my life sucks and their life's going to suck too. Well, great fucking attitude. That's not doing us any good. You have to be strong, and you have to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and keep going. And the people ahead of us that we bring into the world will continue to trudge forward as well. Be a racing and a storming chariot into the future.
Yeah, definitely. We actually we have a caller.
Okay.
205, are you there? 205, are you there? You just listening? Just being weird. Okay, I'm gonna mute you. We have a 618. I don't know if they were just listening, though. Let me check. 618, are you there? All right, probably just listening.
Yeah, I'm just listening.
Oh. Whoops, sorry, cut you off. Well, that's okay. We were just listening.
They were just listening.
I'll just mute you then. Maybe I could read a little bit more of this. since it's pretty relevant, if that's cool with you. We have about a half.
That was great.
Cool. Okay. If it gets boring, let me know. And yeah. Okay. Research done by pioneers of prenatal psychology, such as Dr. Thomas Verney and David Chamberlain, Dr. William Emerson, shows that an overwhelming amount of physical conditions and behavioral disorders are the direct result of traumatic gestation time and complications during delivery, including unnecessary mechanical interventions and an overdose of anesthesia. Also, it turns out on top of the devastating effects of trauma during the actual birth, what happens after it, like routine impersonal postpartum care, is also a source of trouble. Lack of immediate warm, soft, and nurturing contact with the mother, premature cutting of the cord, rude handling, circumcision, needles, bright lights, startling noises. All of this sensory overload becomes instantly wired into the newborn's nervous system as the new comfort zone against all logic. As logic resides in a different part of the brain, which is not quite developed yet. So that person will continue unconsciously recreate / attract the same repeated situation of abuse and or become abusive. Even if later on in life, his or her rational mind or cortex will recognize this as a pattern of abuse, the imprinting had already happened in a different part of the brain, which doesn't have the skill to stop the pattern. According to a 95 study by William Emerson, 95% of all births in the United States are considered traumatic, 50% rated as moderate, and 45% as severe trauma. It affects all of us. Born into excruciating labor pains or into the numbness and toxicity of anesthesia, we are limbically imprinted for suffering and numbness. Traumatic birth strips us of our power and impairs our capacity to love, trust, be intimate, and experience our true potential. Addictions, poor problem-solving skills, low self-esteem, inability to be compassionate, to be responsible, all of these problems have been linked to birth trauma. Normally, a woman gives birth the way she herself was born, due to the mechanism of limbic imprint. It's all her body knows how to procreate. If she was born with complications, it's most likely that she will automatically repeat that scenario unless she consciously alters limbic memory. She will unconsciously hand down her birth trauma to her daughter, as she herself received it from her mother. Giving birth three times is a huge step in healing. That's why the following deliveries are usually much easier. That, of course, is a very general observation. Were you trying to say something? I'm sorry, this is going on. Are you still there? Maybe.
Hello?
Maybe no. Yeah. Sorry. I just thought you were trying to say something.
No, I didn't say anything.
Okay. Sorry. Bloody and violent aspects of human history were created by people who did not receive the nurturing, tender care they needed as babies. Dr. Stan Groff's statistics that 100% of most violent criminals were unwanted babies speaks for itself, loud and clear. Of course, it doesn't mean that all unwanted babies are bound to become criminals. Of course not. Most parents manage to rise up to the challenge, fall in love with their babies after all, and take good care of them. But it does mean that those unfortunate children whose parents could not meet their needs have much less chances of thriving. Historically, most of the masterpieces of human culture reflect the drama of life: jealousy, greed, lust, hate, lost dreams, unrealized potential. Shakespeare's plays, centuries of paintings, classical music are very beautiful ways of speaking about human despair. Only a small fraction of cultural heritage speaks of love, beauty, and fulfillment. Why is that? I think it's because the flow of creative juices is determined by how we feel and experience life, and how we experience life is greatly determined by our limbic imprint. That imprint defines our likes and dislikes, what we find beautiful, attractive, and what repels us. So from what I understand about it, in order to give birth to an enlightened masterpiece, whether it would take form of a human baby or a beautiful poem or a healthy garden or simply a rich, fulfilling day that was worth living, one must first experience being birthed in love. And for those of us who were born long time ago into a less than ecstatic situation, we need to find ways of healing our own birth trauma that was our driving force from day one. Healthy, loving self-parenting can neutralize most of the damage. I'm almost done here. I hope people aren't getting bored, but I think this is a really great piece that this lady wrote, and I'll tell you more about her after. There are many ways of recovery of our sense of well-being, and I am offering one of them in my blah, blah, blah. Healing of one's birth trauma allows one to enjoy the delicious experience of comfortably owning a body, being fully engaged in life and loving it. I think of enjoyment in life as the most practical and secure form of living. Anything other than a deep sense of well-being is very expensive, confusing, and energy-consuming, and we are capable of spending a lot of resources trying to make up for not feeling right inside of our bodies. We can make an effort to heal our own birth trauma and embrace the opportunity of creating a masterpiece of our lives. We can recognize that however rude our beginning was, we do have a choice as adults to change our basic settings, to reprogram our limbic imprint and transmute our suffering and helplessness during birth into the love and joy of being born on this planet. We can regain our authentic power, clear the pain of our ancestors from our system, and set the stage for our children to step into their lives as peaceful, empowered guardians of the earth. I think I'll just kind of stop it there because she just goes on to basically talk about her book. But I think this is so important, the way that we now choose to birth our babies and bring our children, the next generation, into this world. I really think that we have the ability to heal thousands and thousands of years of damage that has been done, and it's in our hands to heal ourselves, to heal, our ancestors. We have a lot of work to do, and I think that birth itself can be used as a tool for healing, and I think that is not really looked into very much. I think that the powers of birth, the energies are so strong, and they can basically rewire our systems completely when done in the right way. It's very, very powerful. I've watched a documentary by this lady who I'm trying to find her name, but it's called Birth into Being. It's actually from Russia. There were a bunch of Russians that were doing research on water birth, and they would go to the Black Sea, and in the warm little lagoons of water there, they started to have babies there, and they realized, well, this is the best place to have a baby in nature. Oh my God. No problems, no complications. Everything was beautiful. There were dolphins swimming around. So this lady has been doing a lot of work over in Russia, and I recommend anybody, really. I mean, you don't even have to be into birth or anything. I just think anybody should watch Birth into Being or Birth as We Know It. The documentaries are available online, and they're in different languages as well. It just shows how we really can heal generations of trauma, of pain, through the birth of new life in the right setting. It's so powerful. It was cool to hear people's stories. Call them, they could actually feel that energy because they were so connected to the woman. I just think that's so cool. And they would just report back having been just changed for the rest of their lives. Even using the term being rewired, things were healed. And I think that is so cool. And it's such a gift that we can give to each other and to future generations. And a lot of healing can take place from that. That's pretty exciting. I hope I'm not boring people or anything, but I think it's so cool. So I hope you're still there. I don't know.
Yeah, it cut out for a minute, so I was just trying to tune in to what I caught because I'm like, wait, what did she say? It was all broken up and crazy, you know. Where you came back in and I could hear you from there is where you said it was like they were being rewired. And then it was like a minute before that I didn't hear anything.
Man, you got to let me know when I cut out for a minute. I'm, like, blabbing on, like I'm making some kind of big point here. No one can
even... anybody else, like, heard, I would have chimed in more effectively. That's what happened there. I actually didn't get a chance to watch that. I actually meant to watch that when I came home from my friends, but it was pretty late, and I just kind of fell asleep, and I didn't watch it yet. But, yeah, you did send me a link to that, and it sounds pretty amazing, and I don't know, like you're doing everything like how it should be, just going outside and doing things as they've always been.
Yeah, it's so cool, too, because the baby that they're giving birth to in the Black Sea, they just know how to swim, you know, so the babies are just swimming in the water with the mom, going underwater, they're swimming around, jumping in the water, swimming with dolphins. I mean, they're all just like bright blonde kids, too. It's really weird. A lot of the kids that were birthed in this area of Russia have bright blonde, I mean, almost white hair. So I think it's really interesting that, you know, this generation of babies is being born that looks like that. And they're little water babies, you know, they can swim and everybody just looks so healthy and happy and normal. It's really beautiful to see. So, you know, we need to follow in the footsteps of the Russians there, because they're really kicking ass over there with, you know, birthing new life and healing generations of bad births, because, you know, Russia wasn't always great for birth either, you know.
They still have a lot of late-term abortion there and things of that sort. That's pretty widespread, so it's really wonderful to see they're trying to save that aspect of their people by doing it in such a way. And I guess somebody said something interesting in the chat. Granted, that was through birth that they healed these old wounds, but one of our few lady listeners that pops in the chat said, I was reading about people who take DMT and other drugs to revisit traumatic births and heal themselves again. And I've heard the same thing through psilocybin. I know that's why that's been really helpful for people who have PTSD from war situations or other happenings in their lives, to say perhaps you're not going to have children anytime soon, where you can go find a nice wading pool and do that. There are some other ways that you can unlock parts of your mind and have a really good experience, at least in my experience with those sorts of things. They've been positive and quite helpful and caused major awakenings in myself. And that could be another really positive and healthy means of doing that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely, yeah, that's why I think it's so silly to demonize, you know, even MDMA, and people might disagree with me on that, but I really do feel that something like MDMA can be used for therapeutic purposes. It was in the beginning. And speaking personally, my experiences with MDMA, it really helped me personally heal a lot of trauma and talk about things that I would never, ever, ever have been able to talk about if I weren't under the influence of that drug.
No, that's cool. I've never myself have done that one in particular. So that's really interesting to hear that, like a firsthand story about it.
Yeah, it's an empathogen. So it lowers all fear and just leaves us wide open to sharing. And man, I really had some breakthroughs, you know, with close friends. Just we would usually take it for that very purpose. We weren't, you know, obviously, yeah, sometimes we would go out and do stupid stuff and go listen to, you know, techno music or something. But a lot of people really, really, I really respected this. And I would like to get a group of my friends together and we just sit around and talk about things that we couldn't talk about otherwise. And I really think that it can be used in a beautiful way. And, you know, if people are going to argue and say, oh, well, it's synthetic and blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, a lot of these people are taking antidepressants every day and they're taking this pill and that pill. So, you know, I think for someone to take a drug once a year or with a specific purpose in mind and a journey and a question they want answered or, you know, a specific reason for it, I think that it can be used for great growth and healing. But just like anything, too much of one thing is not good and not and it's not healthy. Obviously, I don't say go crack once a year. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's a limit.
But, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And I've yet to get a dimethyltryptamine, but that is the that's the same chemical that's released in your brain when you're dying.
And when you're born, I think.
So. Huh?
And when you're born, too, right? Or is it just dying?
I'm not sure, but I have heard definitely it's the same chemical released when you're dying. I could see how it could be when you're born, because I think it's that same sort of entering into some place, and that gets set off in your brain. It gets released in such a way. So, hey, why not? Maybe they don't even know that, but shit, that could be a working theory. but I have had some pretty good experiences with psilocybin, and I haven't done it in a few years. Something I would like to do is to get with some good people and do that. I feel kind of overdue for it. I had really great experiences with that. I will say this: I was when I first did it, I was in undergrad still, and I definitely was still hanging out in the possible, like, I don't think there's anything else going on out there. I think I'm still going to try to force myself to be an atheist or something like that. And after doing that, I was like, nope, all these strange experiences in my life, they can't be explained through a, quote, rational scientific means. It didn't make sense anymore to think that way, and everything kind of came full circle, and it made a lot more sense, and it has some pretty powerful visual aspects going on with that one and some of the other ones, and yeah, it's definitely something that I feel is healthy for me to do once a year, every couple years, and it has some kind of positive growing experience, even with cannabis, you know, which is, that's something I think gets abused a lot. Well, you know, they kind of wake big and they do it all the time, and yeah, and if they're not doing it that much for a chronic pain condition, I think it really strips the fun out of it. You end up kind of getting a tolerance. I don't know, it's just not a good thing to do. Kind of bastardizes it a little bit, and I was never somebody who would do it, use it in that way, but I had a lot of eating problems when I was younger, and I still have appetite problems now. It's unfortunate that I can't access it because of my living situation as much as I need it to eat and sleep sometimes. But when I was going through a period of life where I wasn't really eating at all, having that influence, and I would go outside, you always have to be outside, it made me understand the savor and feel like the dirt that I was sitting in, and really appreciate the growth and beauty that was around me, and that, you know, and of course how it works, and it kind of gets your appetite going, but also because I think being in nature, you know, I wanted to savor things, including food in my mouth, and I was pretty underweight. I was not in a good way with that, and I'd say even though I still have appetite problems, at least I like food now. Like, I want the food, and I have ever since. And I've never, and people relapse into eating problems a lot, and I never felt that I ever had to go back to that place. So these things are really powerful. If they've been powerful for other experiences in our lives, like, yeah, I definitely think they would be remarkable for people. In some, I think it's salvia, which sounds fucking crazy because just what I know of salvia. In southern Mexico, I'm pretty sure in one of my books it says that women giving birth They will use salvia during labor. This is also known to the people who actually use these things during labor as well in certain cultures.
That is crazy. I've tried salvia once in my life and never again. That scared the crap out of me. I hated it.
That's why I haven't. It's been around, and I'm just like, maybe not. I haven't. Somebody told me once that they were a twist tie on a picnic table on a hot day. That's what they turned into. And I'm like, that just sounds really uncomfortable. And then I've heard stranger things, but I didn't want to be uncomfortable, I guess, is how I looked at it. I was like, I don't know.
No, I personally don't like being completely removed from reality. I like to still have my bearings a little bit so I don't feel so out of control. But again, too, you know, we're not trying to, like, tell people to go out, eat a bunch of acid and, you know, like, go trip for it. But I am going to say that I think that if one chooses to do so, you know, psilocybin or some kind of peyote or something, I do think you can really find a lot of control and power within your own mind. And I've found personally through going on certain trips or experiences, because things might start to get real crazy. And, you know, you have to be there and remind yourself that you are in control. And I think it can be a very powerful experience for someone to realize the immense control and power they have over their mind, and how powerful the mind is, and how open we are to suggestions. I don't know how we got off into this topic, but whatever. The last time that I, you know, took a hallucinogen, I would kind of experiment, and I would turn my hallucinations on and off. And I realized that while even I'm under this state, I'm clearly hallucinating right now, I was able to turn it on and off. And I think that is really cool because that just shows us, again, the power of suggestion and the power of our minds. It's incredible. It's incredible.
Totally. And I realized from that point on, like, I had had some lucid type of hypnagogia prior to doing these sorts of things for the first time. But after that, I felt like I became more adept to my lucid dreaming. I became a little better at being able to control it. Like, I was having a really lucid dream about some kind of chase. I don't know, and I'm always armed. There's a lot of chasing, and there's a lot of weaponry, and I'm always shooting at things, or I got a cool sword. I don't know. That might say things about me, but I felt like it, instead of feeling a lot of fear in the dreams, since I could control them more after that, because my mind had already been challenged from these magical plants, that I could control what was happening in these kind of tense sort of lucid dreams. So that's pretty cool. I usually just, even if I know I'm lucid dreaming, I just kind of let it ride depending on what kind of dream it is. But if it's a dream where it looks like it could go kind of sour, it's nice that I have that ability to control it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think if people are open to it, you know, it can teach you a lot. But again, it's like don't abuse that gift, you know, because it really is a gift from nature.
Yeah.
Obviously, some things have been synthesized more, but I think it can be a great tool in healing, as can birth, which is kind of what we were talking about earlier. When it's done in a loving way, and when the process is trusted, and there's not all this fear and scare tactics injected into the woman's mind, and, you know, the baby isn't, you know, under a microscope constantly, and we're just trusting because we can't see what's going on in there. And I really think that freaks a lot of people out, because, well, but we can see everything, you know, we have x-rays, and we have to see in there and see exactly what's going on, because birth is such a mystery. You can't you can't really pinpoint it and say, you know, okay, we know exactly on this day this is going to happen and, you know, this and this. It doesn't follow any kind of timeline or predictable path. So it is a mystery, and it's it needs to be respected, trusted, and I think once we start to do that again, we're going to see some major changes, and the generations being born now that are hopefully not being born in the hospital or being born at home into their own mother's hands or to their own father's hands, step in healing the world, you know, as corny as that sounds. But it's true, because there's been just amounts of death and terrible stuff worldwide for way too long. So,
yeah, and that's especially important to our specific group of people, because it's clearly something that doesn't happen enough for a lot of young, vibrant, virile people aren't having children, or if they do, they have one. And and knowing that these could be good experiences if we do them our own way and go about raising these said people in our own way. You know, I think once people understand that it could be so different, they're gonna be more interested in doing those things. And then and see that it can be a healing experience for that couple, for their growth as to having their own family, and as you said, for the world, for our people, and everything beyond that, it'll keep snowballing.
Definitely. Someone just asked about the documentary. I'm gonna post it in the chat. Let's see. This is just from the website, from what I was reading earlier, but you can find both of the documentaries online there. You can purchase a download or you can purchase a DVD, and they come in a bunch of different languages, which is really cool. But I recommend it. It's just really awesome. So I guess we can wrap it up here. A lot to get into, a lot of, you know, real sad stuff, but, you know, we need to know these things. We can't just ignore them and pretend like it's not going on, because we're just perpetuating the cycles of trauma, and it's
right.
Just not
but
good.
We gave ways into how to undo that, so it's not all lost and dark, you know, we'll be all right. Just,
exactly.
You know,
the real
people know, and they know what action to take to change it, so... And find their own ways to do that as well.
Exactly. And I hope nobody misconstrued our message as us saying that, you know, you shouldn't have kids because trauma, you're going to pass it on to them. I'm absolutely not saying that. I'm actually saying the opposite. Have children and have a beautiful, stress-free pregnancy and birth and trust in the process, and you will heal that trauma through birthing new life in a loving way. That's how we heal. I really think this is like the missing link. So, just go out and have babies, everybody. But not in the hospital. Please don't go to the hospital. Even with midwives, everybody's got to make sure you ask midwives real tough questions, you know, because a lot of them, again, are legally bound. A lot of them don't trust birth. So just another little announcement that birth is normal and safe, and it's good. So I guess we'll close it up. All right, Hex, thanks again. And
thank you.
Next week, thanks everybody for listening. Good night.
Thank you. Night.
Bye.
Come down to the water and borrow time. Gotta wash up that blood now. Come down to the water and rest your head, because Gilda, and now she's dead, and now she's dead, and now she's dead, and now she's dead, and now she's dead. It's a family affair, you're almost there. You can see the sun now and glimpse the beach. Come down to the water to see your daughter. She used to be kind, should have treated her right. Come down to the water, rape your soul and drown your mind and take what you stole. Come down to the water and face the black. You'll never come back.